listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A briefing Tuesday at the United Nations in New York City addressed a number of the hot spots in the world, beginning with the situation in Yemen. This was the spokesperson for the UN Secretary General, Stéphane Dujarric.
Just on the first on the meetings regarding prison exchange, the meeting of the Supervisory Committee on the Implementation of the Prisoner Exchange Agreement for Yemen began in Amman today. Martin Griffiths, the special envoy, said at the outset this is an important meeting and it will lay the basis for the next step, which will be to see the release of prisoners. He made clear that the prisoner exchange is an important issue as it touches the lives of thousands of Yemeni families waiting to be reunited with their loved ones. Also, the implementation of the agreement will help confidence-building measures among the parties on other issues. The committee also includes representatives of the government of Yemen, Ansar al-Ala, and is co-chaired by the special envoy and the International Committee for the Red Cross. Also on Yemen, in Hodeida, Lieutenant General Michael Lollesgaard assumed his duties as the chair of the Redeployment Coordination Committee and head of the UN mission to assist on the Hodeida Agreement, and that is of this evening. Houthi and government of Yemen representatives on the RCC have been continuing to meet yesterday and today aboard the UN vessel that is berthed in Hodeida. The parties have engaged in a long and intense discussions both yesterday and today in order to find mutually acceptable solutions and associated timelines for the implementation of the Hodeida provisions of the Stockholm Agreement. The RCC chair, who chaired the meetings yesterday and today, General Kammert, commended both parties for demonstrating goodwill and engaging constructively together to overcome trust issues and to find viable solutions that would eventually demilitarize the ports in the city of Hodeida, facilitate life-saving humanitarian operations. Weeks of sustained engagement by the chair and his team are beginning to pay off. Today, the parties are closer to agreeing to modalities for phase one of redeployment than they were 6 weeks ago. They're also grappling with the complexities of disengaging forces in close proximity of each other and the gradual deployment of heavy weapons, armor, and infantry. The parties are fully aware of the international spotlight on their efforts to implement the Hodeida Agreement and its implications in the broader peace process for Yemen. Back here in the Security Council, the executive director of the UN Office for Drugs and Crime, Yuri Fedotov, noted that two-thirds of the world's surface is ocean, most of which is not subject to a single state's criminal jurisdiction. He said that transnational maritime crime is increasingly sophisticated and expanding. This was part of an open Security Council meeting on transnational organized crime at sea. And his remarks have been shared with you. Turning to Syria, our humanitarian colleagues remain gravely concerned for the thousands of people fleeing the last Daesh areas in Hajin in Syria's southeastern Deir ez-Zor governorate, as well as for those civilians who remain in the area. Those fleeing report many civilian casualties, including women and children, large-scale destruction of civilian infrastructure, and shortage of food and medicine. Since December of 2018, more than 25,000 people have arrived from the Hajin area to the Al-Hol camp in Al-Hasake governorate, effectively tripling the camp's population to some 35,000 people, and that is surpassing the maximum capacity. Since the 22nd of January, around 10,000 people have arrived at the site. As of yesterday, 35 children have reportedly died either en route or shortly after arriving in the camp since December, mostly from hypothermia. The UN and humanitarian partners are continuing to scale up the responses at the camp. 24-hour teams have been set up to receive the newly displaced, quickly identify the most vulnerable cases, and provide urgent assistance, including medical and protection support. The UN continues to call on all parties to the conflict and those with influence over them to take all measures to ensure the protection of civilians and civilian infrastructure in line with their obligations under international humanitarian law. And the UN and the Libyan Government of National Accord today launched the 2019 Humanitarian Response Plan for the country, seeking $202 million to provide health, support, protective, water and sanitation, shelter and education to support more than 550,000 vulnerable people. 7 years of instability and insecurity have taken a heavy toll on the well-being of tens of thousands of children, women and men in Libya, with thousands of families unable to afford food, water, basic household items. According to the Office of Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, at least 823,000 people across Libya, including 250,000 children, are in need of humanitarian assistance. This includes internally displaced people and returnees, conflict-affected people, host communities, and refugees and migrants who face grave human rights violations and abuse in the absence of the rule of law. You can find the Humanitarian Response Plan for Libya online. Also in Libya, the World Health Organization today warned of increasing attacks on health facilities and workers. The agency has documented more than 41 attacks targeting health workers and facilities across the country over the past year. These attacks resulted in 6 health workers and patients being killed, 25 health workers injured. Additional 7 health workers were also assaulted during the period. More information online. And today is Safer Internet Day, and our colleagues at the UN Children's Fund are highlighting the dangers posed to young people by online violence, cyberbullying, and digital harassment. According to the data from UNESCO on the prevalence of cyberbullying in high-income countries, the proportion of children and adolescents who are affected by cyberbullying ranges from 5 to 21%, with girls appearing to be more likely to experience cyberbullying than boys. In a statement issued today, the executive director of UNICEF, Henrietta Fore, called for greater action to make the internet a safer place for everyone, adding that it is time for governments, families, academia, and the private sector to put children and young people at the center of digital policies. More information online. And today we also officially celebrate the Lunar New Year. 2019 is the year of the pig. And in his message, the Secretary General sent his best wishes to those celebrating and said the new year is an opportunity to join hands to build a peaceful and prosperous world for all, leaving no one behind. That is it. I just want to flag, that tomorrow, 11 a.m. in the Visitors Lobby, the UN Population Fund will launch a photo exhibit to mark the International Day of Zero Tolerance Against Female Genital Mutilation. The exhibit sheds light on harmful practices that is still prevalent in many parts of the world. You're welcome to attend. And today we say thank you to Montenegro and Österreich. There we go. Joe, you get the question.
Thank you.
You yield.
Thank you. Particularly in light of the recent observance of the remembrance of the Holocaust at the UN and the Secretary General's statements with respect to that observation and remembrance, I'd like to know what the Secretary General's comments are with regard to Cameroon's Minister Delegate of Justices warning to President Biya's opponents that they, quote, might end up like arrogant Jews whom Hitler put in gas chambers. Thank you.
The Secretary General has stood and will continue to stand against any anti-Semitic statements or statements that incite violence. Mr. Biya.
Particularly, I mean, the reference to the Holocaust and the Jews was in the context of what could happen to Cameroonians.
I haven't seen the particular statement, but I'm telling you what our reaction is. Yes, Mr. Bays.
On Yemen, just a little bit of some clarification to the useful statements that you put out. Who is in charge of the RCC now? Because it seems you have two generals.
No, we have
currently in Yemen.
We have one general at a time. So General Lola's Guard has arrived in Yemen, I think, yesterday. And as of this evening, he has taken over the chairmanship of the RCC.
Right.
It was very important for us to have both. There were, let me just put it this way, there were two generals, one chair.
Okay, and in terms of the chair, General Kamat is still on the ship right now. Are those talks have finished that you gave us a readout of, or are they continuing?
I gave you what I knew, which is the talks continued today.
Continued, but do you...
Continued today.
Are you keeping them on that ship for another day?
I think we will go to reporting one day at a time.
One assumes General Lola's Guard, if they are continuing,
yes,
on the ship.
Yes, he is the chair.
He will join the vessel.
He was there.
He was there.
He was there. And
okay.
This was to ensure the smoothest possible handover, which is what we've been talking about. And General Lola's Guard assumed his duties as chair and head of the assistance mission as of this evening.
Okay, understood.
Carol. No, you will. One second.
Sorry, the statement says the discussions are continuing tomorrow.
So, yeah.
Okay. What is phase one of redeployment?
I would have to refer you back to the text of the agreement. Yeah. Ben.
Yeah, follow up on that. No. Since you have two generals in the room, did they ever get the two sides in the dispute in the same room?
They're on the ship together. That's what we've been reporting.
But are they,
are they
conducting negotiations with both sides present?
As far as I know, they're in the same room. They're not in separate berths.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
International.
Yep. I think you have to press the light on your microphone. Yep. There we go.
Okay. I have to... Repeat, Hebel Maghrabi,
yes.
International Daily Bulletin. I have two questions regarding the meeting that took place in the outcome of the Jordanian meeting. It took place yesterday. And regarding the agreement of the release of the Houthis, the release of the hostages. I knew that the Houthis requested only two hostages to be released.
Are you talking about the prisoner exchange?
Yes.
Yeah.
And out of 1,300, so
I mean, those discussions are ongoing. I don't have any more details. We can ask our colleagues who are on the ground, but I don't have numbers with me here.
Okay, but we'll
come back to my office. We'll see what more we can get for you.
Okay, thanks.
James.
Thanks, Stefan. One more detail on the Yemen talks, the Hodeidah talks. Do you know the name of the lead negotiator for the Houthi side and the government side? And has it been the same individual in both cases throughout since the talks began in January?
I will check. I will check. Yes, and then Carla. Go ahead. Yes, please.
A report to the UN Security, to the UN Sanctions Committee that was obtained by journalists yesterday suggests that North Korea tries to protect and disperse testing, assembly, and storage of its nuclear missile capabilities. Can you confirm that information, or do you have any comment on that?
No, those reports are addressed directly to the Sanctions Committee, Security Council Sanctions Committee. I haven't seen the report, and we don't see them. Those are for Security Council members. Carla.
Thank you. The Times has been publishing very, very large articles about Mr. Alston's report on the effect of austerity measures on increased poverty in England. Do you know how we can get the report, and is there any chance of bringing him here for a press briefing?
The reports usually of the special rapporteurs are online. There is a season during which special rapporteurs tend to migrate to New York, but I think that's in the fall. Mm-hmm. That being said, he may be available through our colleagues in Geneva. Dulcie.
Yeah, regarding Lala's guard, so how long is his appointment for?
Until further notice. Yes, Benny.
Does the Secretary General have any comment on the nomination of David Malpass for World Bank?
No. That's a process that involves the World Bank, its executive board. First of all, I've read the press reports. I'm not aware that it's been officially nominated, but it's a decision that involves the executive board of the World Bank and not the Secretary General of the United Nations. You've been very patient.
Thank you. Again.
There you go.
All right. I have a question because the Secretary Council yesterday, he issued a statement regarding ceasing of fire. But what happened to that, like a couple of hours later? The ceasing of fire between the two parties.
Oh, the ceasefire. Yes. I'm sorry.
So what happened to that, the Houthis, 1 hour later, they started shooting. And so what did the UN, what was the role of the UN in this particular issue?
The ceasefire in Hodeidah has been largely holding. I think what is important that we have not seen either party try to use the ceasefire to gain further territory. The agreement is what it is. It is not unsurprising that there may be some sporadic fire here and there, but as far as we're concerned, it is generally holding.
I'm sorry, just to follow up. Mm-hmm. Did the UN condemn any of the Houthis action that happened yesterday? Because after the issuing of the statement, they started shooting. So
I'm not sure that the UN was able to determine the source of any firing. Yes, James. But we call on all parties to continue and observe the ceasefire. You have to hand over the microphone to your neighbor.
I'm coming back to the berths on that ship. Just to be clear, the Houthi delegation came a day after the coalition delegation, I remember that. Mm-hmm. But no one has left the ship. They're not leaving at night. They are all staying on this ship, is your understanding.
That is...
And that brings me to my question.
I'm not the steward on the ship, but
you're not. No, but you are having both sides, yeah, and you take them into the ocean, yeah, onto a ship, explain to me the thinking of sort of cooping them up together and what that might achieve.
Well, they're not at sea. They're berthed. So, I mean, you know, we're not sailing out to sea with them. I think it was a creative solution by our colleagues on the ground to find a place that both parties could agree to go to a place that is relatively secure. I will leave it to those who have greater experience in managing negotiations as to the psychological effect of putting people on a ship.
NATO has added yet another East European country to its membership rolls. The former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia is now a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg and Macedonia's Foreign Minister Nikola Dimitrov held a press conference in Brussels on Wednesday following the signing of the Accession Protocol. The nation is now called the Republic of North Macedonia and it's NATO's 30th member. This was the NATO Secretary General and North Macedonian Foreign Minister at the press conference in Brussels Wednesday.
So, Foreign Minister Dimitrov, dear Nikola, it's really great to see you here. Welcome back to the NATO headquarters. You have been here before, but today is a special day because today we signed the accession protocol for your membership in the alliance. Today is a historic day for your country and a proud day for us all. NATO ambassadors have just signed the accession protocol for the future Republic of North Macedonia. I want to congratulate both Skopje and Athens for showing commitment and courage in reaching an agreement on the name issue. We can now look to the future as allies start to ratify the protocol. Once all allies have ratified the protocol, Skopje will become the 30th member of the alliance. Membership will give you a seat at the North Atlantic Council. You will have an equal voice in shaping the decision we take as allies. You already make important contributions to our shared security, contributing to our mission in Afghanistan, promoting regional cooperation in the southeast of Europe, and you're also implementing major reforms. NATO keeps almost 1 billion citizens across Europe and North America secure. And with you joining NATO, there will be 30 countries committed to protect each other. Your accession will bring more stability to the Western Balkans. This is good for the region and for the Euro-Atlantic security. From today, your country will participate in NATO meetings as an invitee. We look forward to welcoming Defense Minister Radmila Shekarinska as early as next week and to inviting Prime Minister Zaev to the leaders' meeting. I'm happy to announce that the meeting, the leaders' meeting, will take place in December in London. London was our first headquarters in 1949, so this is an ideal setting to mark NATO's 70th anniversary. We are grateful to the UK for agreeing to host the meeting and for playing a key role in our alliance over the decades. Nicola, today's signing of the accession protocol shows what diplomacy and statesmanship can achieve. And I really look forward to seeing 30 Allied flags outside the NATO headquarters. So once again, welcome to the NATO headquarters. Congratulations with the signing of the accession protocol. And we look forward to welcoming you at the NATO Foreign Ministerial Meeting in Washington in April. So once again, welcome.
Thank you so much, dear Jens. This is a historic day. It's been a long journey. We've had 18 cycles of the Membership Action Plan, to give you an illustration. And it didn't just happen. I think as with people, for countries as well, history doesn't simply happen. You have to make it happen. And what I did with the North Atlantic Council, I'm going to do also with you, the representatives of the media, the public. I'd like to acknowledge and praise the leadership of Prime Minister Zaev, of Prime Minister Tsipras. It was easier not to do this. So by no means this historic reconciliation was inevitable. It was not even likely. It was easier to sit in the trenches of history. It was easier to even score political points by maintaining the dispute. But what they dared to do was invest political capital for the benefit of the two peoples of the two nations and the whole region and NATO as a family, as an alliance. I pledged our commitment to continue with what we promised, which is continue with the reforms, both on the side of the rule of law, but also on the side of the intelligence sector reforms and the defense modernization. A country is as strong as its military. It is also as strong as its democratic institutions are functional and healthy. But it is also as strong as the number of close friends it has. Our journey is not over. We look forward to parliaments in 29 allies ratifying the accession protocol. But what's important for us is we will never walk alone again. And we stand beside these 29 allies, NATO member states, able and ready to assume the obligations arising from our full membership in NATO. For us, NATO is about making the world more peaceful, more stable. We will do our part when it comes to NATO missions, and we will also do everything that we can to make sure that our region, Southeastern Europe or the Balkans, is a region that is more predictable, more stable, and more prosperous. It's been a great day today. Thank you so much.
Okay, we have a couple time for a couple of questions. Radio Free Europe at the back here.
Brekka Josfiak, Radio Free Europe. As for NATO Secretary General, we understand that Macedonia is politically ready, but are they militarily ready as well, considering that they only spend 1% of GDP on military? The budget doesn't look too great there. The military is fairly small. So what do you say about the military preparedness of this potentially new member state?
I think we have to understand that the enlargement of NATO with the future Republic of North Macedonia will strengthen NATO for different reasons. Partly it will contribute to stability in the southeast of Europe. That is important for the whole alliance. But partly they have shown that they can contribute to our shared security because the country is already participating in NATO missions and operations. We exercise together with them. They participate in our mission in Afghanistan. And what we have seen is that they have been able to implement reforms, modernizing their defense institutions, their security institutions. And they have pledged and they have clearly committed to continue to modernize and strengthen their defense institutions and the armed forces. What we have seen is that defense spending is now going up, is increasing. And it's a clear commitment from the government in Skopje to meet the NATO guideline of spending 2% of GDP on defense by 2024. So as many other allies, they adapt, they invest, and I look forward to having them as a full member because that will strengthen NATO, it will stabilize the region, and it, of course, will provide the security guarantees for the future Republic of North Macedonia.
Okay, we have the Portuguese TV there.
Thank you. Susana Freixas, SIC Portugal. Actually, my question is on the next meeting of NATO leaders in London. I would like to understand why London, taking into account the Brexit process and when we don't know whether the UK is going to be part of the EU in December or not. Is there a political message in this decision by, of course, the NATO? Thank you.
So Brexit will change UK's relationship to the European Union, but it will not change the United Kingdom's relationship to NATO. So for me, it's perfectly natural that UK is hosting the leaders' meeting at the end of the next year, not least because London was the first seat for the NATO headquarters back in 1949 when the alliance was established, and the first Secretary General of the alliance was actually a Brit. So Britain, the United Kingdom, is a founding member of NATO, and we started in London with our first headquarters. So we are extremely grateful to the government of the United Kingdom, to Prime Minister May, for the offer to host the next leaders' meeting, and that will be part of the way we mark the 70th anniversary of our alliance.
Okay, Georgian TV in yellow.
Georgian TV, Rustavi Tutamara Nutsubidze. First of all, congratulations. And as you know, this day also very important for Georgia, for our people. What do you think? What does it show and what does it mean for Georgia? Thank you.
It shows that NATO's door remains open for countries that meet the NATO standards and that adhere to the NATO values of democracy, the rule of law, and individual liberty. And we are very encouraged by what we see in Georgia, the commitment to reforms, the commitment to strengthening defense and security institutions, transparency, judiciary reforms. And therefore, we welcome also the very clear commitment by NATO leaders at the summit in July that Georgia will become a member of the alliance. They reiterated the decision we made back in Bucharest in 2008. And we have actually stepped up the cooperation with Georgia. We are grateful for all the support Georgia provides to NATO in NATO missions and operations. But also we see that NATO is actually stepping up support and cooperation with Georgia. So we will continue to support Georgia as it moves towards NATO membership.
Open TV, Greece.
Hello, I'm Maria Psara, Open TV, Greece. I don't want to bring bad news, but is there any way that this procedure of Skopje accession in NATO can go wrong? And political resolutions can play any role in both by both countries in NATO? Thank you.
I can start on that, perhaps Nicolò can can add some remarks. But just to say that I'm really impressed by the courage, by the political will, by the commitment of both the government in Athens and the government in Skopje, and especially the leadership of Prime Minister Tsipras and Prime Minister Zaev. Because this is really leaders who have been able to make history, to shape history. And that they have done so by overcoming divisions, solving an issue that has been a big problem for the region, for the countries, and actually also for both the aspirations to enlarge NATO and the European Union.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. While President Trump's decision to pull the U.S. troops out of Syria got all the headlines, the simultaneous American push for a NATO-like Arab military alliance went largely unnoticed. Can the idea of collective security work in such a consistently insecure region as the Middle East? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hassan Nafa, political science professor at Cairo University. Professor Nafa, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
It's ironic, isn't it, that the Trump administration, while continuing to put pressure on NATO, at the same time seems enamored by the idea of a similar alliance in the Middle East. And from what I heard, three countries already, Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, have signaled their openness to the plan. Do you think that interest is genuine, or are they just trying to placate President Trump?
Well, I think this is an Israeli effort, and the the U.S. administration has been taking the idea, and the whole objective is to try to integrate the Israel in the Arab system. So they are trying to convince the Arab world, and some Arab world are already convinced that Iran and not Israel became the real enemy and is threatening the whole Arab world, is expanding its influence and so on. And also, do the United States, especially after withdrawing from the treaty on the nuclear program. So it is perceived as the interest of the United States, as the interest of other Arab countries, especially the Saudi Arabia, and the and Israel is delighted about it, because this is a way that it will make the Arabs forget about the conflict with the Israelis.
If I may interject here, because with Mr. Trump, the first question is always who is going to fit the bill, and that the Trump administration has been pretty blunt with the Europeans for not contributing enough to the NATO budget. Who do you think will pay for this endeavor if it indeed comes into reality?
As it has happened many, many times, it is the Saudi Arabia who will pay, also with the United Arab Emirates. Trump has been saying all the time that these countries are so rich, they don't pay for their security. We are supporting the burden. And I think this, about the cost, there is no problem. The Saudis are really ready for that. But more important in my view is the idea of reintegrating Israel in the whole Arab world, and you bring Israel and the Saudi Arabia and the Emirates together, and this is a big change in the whole Middle East strategy.
Sure, the Saudis are the only ones who have money to spend in the region, because Egypt at this point of time is a recipient of military aid, so is Jordan. But do you think the Saudis can be trusted with that? Because if they are the ones paying for that, can you really build a proper balanced alliance as opposed to just having a paymaster with a few client states?
But it is not the question of the cost of an operation that will be paid by Saudi Arabia. As a matter of fact, it is a sort of draining Saudi Arabia because to sell more arms and so on. So if you are talking about the cost of a real military operation, we have to see what kind of military operation, what will be done on the ground, if there will be an attack against Iran, or it is just an alliance, a defensive alliance. In my understanding, it will not be at all a defensive alliance. So it is not a sort of a collective security, because none of these countries are really threatened by Iran. It is what is needed now is to, in my own analysis, a regime change in Iran. So putting a lot of pressure, economic pressure, military pressure, and trying maybe to make some attempts to change Iran from within. So I think it will take some time, and all this will cost a lot of money. But in the same time, the idea of integrating Israel is a locomotive of all what is going on in the Middle East for the moment.
Mm-hmm. But Professor Nefa, all the efforts to contain the Iranian influence in the region have so far failed. Is forming a military alliance really going to make that much of a difference?
I don't think it will make any difference unless you are really ready to attack Iran, and to find ways or how to make a regime change. This will be a total failure. This will not stop expanding influence in Yemen, in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, and so on. So this strategy has failed. But now Trump wants to send some message both to the American people and also to some recipients in the Middle East that Trump or the American administration is ready to face the same threat for the United States and for the Arab countries. This is the idea. And so the Saudi Arabia already announced that they are ready to pay the cost. But what cost, how much time that will take, this is a big question, and we don't know exactly what this new alliance will do in the Middle East. If there is no plans for a military action, I think this will be a total failure. And I am not quite sure that this idea of attacking Iran militarily will work, because the Iranians have the means to retaliate.
I'm sorry for interrupting you here, but I wanted to pursue that question about the Saudi contribution. You mentioned that they are likely to bankroll the creation of that alliance, but I suspect that they would also want to put some influence on that alliance. And from what we've seen so far, the major military operation so far is the war in Yemen, which has been executed not only in very brutal terms, but from a military point of view, very, very inefficiently. Don't you think that the Americans also have to be mindful about giving the Saudis so much power and influence if indeed that alliance is formed?
No, as a matter of fact, this will not give the Saudis any influence whatsoever. The United States will lead. And I think the mastermind in all this operation will be Israel. And it is identical strategy, but led by Israel. And the United States is convinced that in Trump's administration, that this is also a United States interest and not only Israel. So the main beneficiaries will be Israel on one hand, the United States on the other hand. But what they will do, this is the issue. Unless there is a plan for a military action against Iran, that will not change anything. The Iranians have a lot of cards to play, and they didn't play all their cards until now. Look what's going on in Lebanon, for example. The Saudi Arabia has been trying very hard to change the political situation in Lebanon. They failed. The new government, which was formed a few days ago, is not a pro-Saudi at all in a way. Hezbollah is still maintaining a very strong position within Lebanon. The Iranians gain more influence, and I don't think that the new the NATO, the Arab NATO, will change anything in this mechanism at all.
I know that you recently suggested that Egypt should try and use this opportunity to leverage the Trump administration to settle or at least advance on the Palestinian issue. Do you think this is something that still motivates both the Arab leaders and their Arab public? Is there still an interest in the Palestinian cause?
Well, the Arab people are still interested in the Arab cause. They consider it as vital. But the problem is that all the Arab states have their inner problems. If the Arab regimes, including and especially Saudi Arabia and Emirates, went too far in cooperating with Israel, this will be very badly perceived by the Arab public opinion, and I think they will even lose some of their legitimacy. They lost it already, and look what happened after the killing of Khashoggi, for example. The Saudi ability to move in the Middle East, to have influence, is very tight now, as long as Mohammed bin Salman is leading Saudi Arabia. Unless there is a change of leadership inside Saudi Arabia, I don't think that the Saudi influence will gain at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you know, I come from Russia, and Russia is very, very allergic to anything that has to do with NATO or any sort of collective security with the United States at the helm. Given that Moscow is playing an increasingly more active role in the region, do you think it should be concerned about this idea of an NATO-like structure in that part of the world?
Of course, it should be concerned, but it is in the interest of Russia to play it down. I mean to avert all the efforts and leading to the form this kind of alliance, because this will impact the Russian policy, especially in Syria. And you know that Israel is pushing too hard to get the Iranians out of Syria. So if this alliance is formally done, I think this will have some, they will try to compromise the Russian policy in Syria. And so the Israeli military will have a free hand to strike even more frequently and more strongly against the Iranian target, and this will embarrass very much the Russian objectives in Syria. So it is in the interest of Russia to abort all the efforts in this direction.
Professor Nafar, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Hassan Nafar, political science professor at Cairo University. Professor Nafar, we are recording this interview a few weeks after Egypt marked the 8th anniversary of the 2011 revolution, which put an end to 30 years of Hosni Mubarak's rule. Apart from that, what would you count as the achievements or perhaps the failures of Egypt since then?
Well, I think there is a general feeling of disappointment since the revolution. As a matter of fact, the Egyptian people revolted against Mubarak to have another political system that you have more social justice, more respect of human dignity, and so on. But if you look to what is going on in Egypt right now, most of the people have the feeling that it was even better during Mubarak regime. It doesn't mean that they want Mubarak regime to come back, but they don't feel any amelioration of their situation. Thousands of people are arrested and in prison, and so there is a feeling of disappointment, especially with the idea that the regime wants to reform or to change the constitution.
Let me ask you specifically about that, because a few years ago when President al-Sisi was posed the same question as I just asked you about the main achievements in Egypt since the revolution, he said that the introduction of presidential term limit was the main achievement. Here's exactly what he had to say. Let's listen.
I'll tell you something. In years gone by, the idea that the ruler could be changed or the possibility of him losing an election was unimaginable. Now it is one or two terms in office maximum.
Now, President al-Sisi gave that interview in 2015. Do you think there is still no third option?
No, I think he has been changing his ideas about this all the time. First of all, he said he will stay just for one mandate. And then he has been saying the constitutions are not written with the good intentions. And I think everybody has been guessing that finally he will be trying very hard to get the constitution amended, especially to change the mandate. I think the proposal is to make two terms for 6 years. But since he might open the door for himself to be a candidate for the 2022 election, so if this is really done, it means that President Sisi will stay in power not only for 8 years, but for 8 plus 12, it means that he will be staying in power for 20 years. And I don't think that the Egyptian people will welcome this at all. That's why, in my own sense, this is the opening of a real political battle. There is no doubt that the Sisi regime will try to impose the kind of reform that he thinks will pour into his own interest. And this is because the parliament, his own, and I am afraid that there will be, at some point, there will be a real political explosion. But this couldn't happen, but we don't have to exclude that possibility in my own sense.
There are lots of governments with pretty consolidated parliament, Russia being one of them, Turkey another, and they tried a different model when they essentially swapped prime minister and president and then swapped them back. There are ways of keeping the government in power without necessarily changing the constitution. Why do you think the Egyptian authorities seem to be moving towards breaking with the promises that they gave only 2-3 years ago, when there seems to be an easier way of pulling what they want to do, which is to stay in power?
No, but the main gain after the 2011 revolution is to limit the presidential mandates with two terms only. So and also there is the article 226 totally forbidding any amendment of this particular mandate. Unless it is for more guarantees of liberties and so on. So what, the idea of amending this particular article is totally forbidden, and I think there will be a real constitutional crisis. But anyway, we are at the beginning of the second mandate, so Al-Sisi still have three years and a half, and we don't know why he is insisting to do it right now, and do not wait to see whether the political situation will be ameliorated or not. So it is a sort of an obscure idea, and we don't know exactly what going on in his mind. I already said in one of my tweets that I cannot imagine President Sisi as a formal president. So he will be trying to stay in power for life. This is my, I hope I am wrong, this is what I do believe.
Mm-hmm. You said that we cannot understand what is in the president's head, and yet in many of his interviews, he does make a point that it's difficult, perhaps even impossible, to live up to Western democratic standards while dealing with the host of issues that he has to deal with, first and foremost security and terrorism. Are you willing to concede him that point, that he is facing an extremely difficult situation and desperate times call for desperate measures?
But everybody is against terrorism. The question is whether his policy is effective to try to eliminate terrorism. I think it is getting worse and worse, as a matter of fact. You don't have to rely only on security measures, but you have to deal with the question of terrorism by all the means, economic, social, cultural, and so on. And if you don't have a country that it is, that the people are totally behind you, and they are supporting the the policy of the government. So you will be perceived as trying to use or to exploit terrorism as a mean to stay in power for life. And this is the kind of impression that people and more and more people have about the policy to fight terrorism. This is not an effective policy at all. There is some security in the country if you compare it to 6 or 7 years ago, but this is the output of a kind of fear that the most of the population fear the security apparatus, the heavy-handed police in Egypt, and not there is no consensus about his policy, neither on economic issues nor on security issues, and even the policy to fight terrorism. We don't have the impression that it is really working because we don't see it eliminated.
Well, you know, I just came back from a trip to Egypt a few days ago, and I indeed found it far, far more restrictive than it was during the Mubarak era or during the Morsi year. But I've also heard many people say that this tightening of screws is really happening across the region, from Turkey to Jordan and many other countries. Is Egypt really such an exception here, or is it perhaps part of a broader trend?
Well, the situation in Egypt is different. You cannot compare Egypt with some other countries where you have civil war. We don't have civil war. We don't have the kind of political struggle as it is in Libya, for example, or in Yemen, or in Syria, or even in Iraq. There has been always a strong central government in Egypt, but we have never seen this kind of repressive regime. I myself, because from time to time, I simply write articles which is not really with the and supporting the policy of the government. I am searched every time I get out. I travel abroad, and when I come back from my travel, I am searched again, and so on. I don't see it very useful at all, and I see it as a repressive way trying to terrorize the opposition. And I don't see that this kind of policy will really work on either on any level.
When the Egyptian president is pressed on those issues that you mentioned, he also makes the point that if Egypt were to disintegrate, Europe and the West would feel that first in the form of many, many millions of refugees. And that may seem like a veiled threat, but that isn't that also true that regardless of how unsatisfactory the situation may be at the moment, it could still be much, much worse.
And due to a technical problem, you will have to wait for the answer to that question, and we'll have that for you later this week.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.